And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week marks the end of Tina Fey's 30 Rock after 7 seasons. One of the many ways it made its mark was its enthusiastic embrace of meta-commentary on show business, plain old business, and comedy. We'll talk about how much meta is too much and how those who know it well make it work for them. And speaking of meta, no, really, we're taking a few minutes for a PCHH FAQ this week. We'll answer some of your common queries about the show and how we got here. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I edit movies coverage and other stuff for the NPR website.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, I am happy to see all of you, of course.
It is a pleasure to be here.
But not so happy about the fact that 30 Rock, which for a while I was quite impatient with, has sort of seen a resurgence this season, I feel. But, I mean, obviously, I'm very glad to see it go out on a positive note. But by the time you hear this podcast, it will have already aired its finale.
Yeah, none of us have seen the last episode of 30 Rock. And I have actually, truth be told, once it started to sag a bit, I actually kind of dropped out and am now several seasons behind.
Yeah. I stuck with it, and I think I agree, it's having some of the best episodes it's ever had here in the last season.
Yeah, I think they've had some very good episodes. What we talked about with this show is that 30 Rock, the television show, is about TGS, the fake television show, which is also on NBC.
Right.
And NBC in this universe is owned by GE. And many of the same things are true of NBC that are true of NBC in real life.
Right. And they're poking fun at their corporate overlords.
Exactly.
And product integration.
Right. And they've also, you know, they also have a lot of conversations about comedy, and they're playing a lot with the nature of comedy. So first, we should probably get a definition of what we mean when we say meta on the table.
Right.
So, Stephen, why don't you give your definition?
Okay. Meta is sort of, I'm sure it's Latin or something, but the definition that we're going with is sort of when a piece of entertainment comments upon itself and sort of, as they say, lifts the fourth wall, becomes very self-referencing, almost in a loop. And so you're enjoying the thing, but you're also enjoying the commentary on how they're making the thing.
Right.
Sure. And it's not simply turning to the audience and breaking the fourth wall. I think there's another step beyond that, correct? Do we agree on that?
It's heavily flavored often, anyway, with irony, a sense of distancing the content itself from the forms and tropes that the content might be employing.
Right. Absolutely true. Absolutely true. So I think on 30 Rock, an example of all of this is, as I said, the NBC on the show is very similar in many ways to the NBC in real life. But of course, the NBC that they're making fun of on the show is presumably they're not saying all of these things are true of real NBC. But it's been, for me, when you have meta commentary like this and the thing is commenting on itself, it's very easy for that to go a little bit up its own nose, shall we
clever.
Say.
pick an orifice.
Right. Clever for the sake of clever. I was trying to think of examples where it didn't work for me, and I kept coming up with ones that did. Especially when I was young, before you realize that the fourth wall can be broken and that something can comment on itself, seeing it happen is a revelation.
Right.
Seeing it happen is tremendously exciting. And you can get kids started on this process right away with something like the monster at the end of this book, the Sesame Street book, where Grover is addressing the audience, and he's not just addressing the audience, he's telling you, don't turn the page.
Right. You are reading a book. I am in a book. Here I am in a book.
Exactly. And there's an app now where you can actually download the monster at the end of this book onto your iPad or iPhone.
That seems wrong.
So you can experience it.
The monster at the end of this app.
But I kept thinking about all these examples that I really picked up on when I was a kid. Duck Amuck.
Absolutely.
A Looney Tunes in which Daffy Duck has some travails with the cartoonist who is animating his adventure.
Maybe my favorite cartoon of all time.
That cartoon gets awfully existential, awfully quickly.
Farewell to sea, farewell to the sea. The wind will carry back our savvy freak. One last embrace before we say, Buster, it may come as a complete surprise to you to find that this is an animated cartoon. And that in animated cartoons, they have scenery. And in all the years I... All right, wise guy.
Oh, because he's erasing his own.
He's erasing his bill or something.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he's
a close-up, you jerk! A close-up! it's maybe the funniest thing ever.
It's better. It's great. He's screaming at the heavens. Literally, he's screaming at the heavens to this remorseless god who is torturing him.
Watch this cartoon now instead of talking.
Exactly. Zim Zim Hooray is a Roadrunner cartoon, which starts out like every other Roadrunner cartoon. And at a moment, all of a sudden, what happens about 30 seconds, 40 seconds in, is that the camera pulls back into a living room where we see two kids watching the Roadrunner cartoon.
Yeah, yep, yep.
And they ask each other, why does he chase the Roadrunner
right.
all the time?
Oh,
and Wile E. Coyote stops in his tracks, and he basically does a TED Talk at that point. pulls out a chart and explains how delicious Roadrunners are with a pointer and everything like that.
I forgot all about
that. So if you want to get kids started and involuted and thinking about things, I found that writing about writers bores me to tears. Mm-hmm. Writing about writing also bores me to tears because it's just about people.
But, that was a fake out.
But writing about the form itself, novels about what novels are or what novels do. John Gardner, who was in many ways a very influential teacher but also kind of a bully, was fond of saying, fiction is a vivid and continuous dream.
Right. You said this on maybe our first show ever.
Possibly. So vivid because it's available to the senses, but continuous is very, very important. In his mind, you don't want to break...
Inception. It was when we talked about Inception.
Sure. You don't want to have the record skip.
Right.
There are writers who delight in skipping that record. Mm-hmm, there are mm-hmm. artists. There are playwrights. There mm-hmm. are movie makers who delight in having the record skip. I started reading Italo Calvino when I was very young. Borges, Vonnegut does this. Mm-hmm. Nabokov, in a way. I tried reading Tristram Shandy by Lauren Stone several times and still haven't made it through.
And they're commenting on the form.
They're commenting on the form of the novel, the fact that you're reading a novel. People today, like Lydia Davis, does this as well. It's tremendously exciting, but I want to toss it around to the table. When does it not work? When do you find it annoying? Mm.
The example that I would throw out there, and this is a very well-liked movie, mm-hmm. but I had this problem with the movie adaptation. Mm-hmm. It's Spike Jonze. It's a Charlie Kaufman script. It's, you know, stars Nicolas Cage. It's very much in the Being John Malkovich family. It has that lineage, and it was, I thought, very reflexively loved. And there are some wonderful performances in that movie. Chris Cooper is great in that movie. It's a good movie, but at the same time, at the heart of it is basically every high school freshman's, I'm going to write a paper about writing a paper. I'm going to write a story about mm-hmm. writer's block. Oh, mm-hmm. and then he blah, blah, blah. Like, yeah. what was the last refuge of the writer's block addled high school freshman is to write about how you can't write about anything.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I feel like my take on this particular lifting of the fourth wall is you have to do it sparingly. And you have to do it, I think, once you have established the affection of the person who's watching.
I think you have to establish that you can do without it, and then you can do it.
I think that's right. And an example that I would throw out as a positive example is the Save Our Bluths episode of Arrested Development, mm-hmm. where the show is nearing cancellation. Everybody who's watching the show by this point is obsessed with the show, loves the show, wants to save the show. And so the show is sort of riffing on that and doing the whole thing like the 3D effects and all the different clowning around and referencing mm-hmm. the plight of the show mm-hmm. as the plight of this family. And I thought that worked in part because it's 48 episodes into this show's run. And as much as that show has a little airs of that, it's got a narrator
sure.
and there are
sure.
other instances. But when you really dive into meta commentary all throughout, and that's all the episode is, mm-hmm. it's earned that.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like a movie like Adaptation, as much as you have the affection for the people involved in the movie going in, and I do think it's a fun movie, mm-hmm. the movie hasn't earned that.
Yeah. Another example, very similar to what you said about Arrested Development, that I would bring up as I always do. You love Arrested Development and talk about it all the time. I love Sports Night and talk about mm-hmm. it all the time. Sports Night did a similar, pretty much the entire second season of that show, which it only ran for two seasons. Pretty much the entire second season of that show is about your network screwing around with your show because it doesn't have the ratings that they want,
right.
which is essentially what was happening to that show. And it all builds to this line right near the end where Clark Gregg from the Avengers is playing the guy who's sort of showing up and potentially wants to try to save the show. And he shows up and says at one point, anyone who can't make money off of Sports Night does not belong in the money-making business or something like that. And it worked because the show on the show was called Sports Night and the show was... But to me, that was one that worked partly because it had been built to that point where you could get away with a line like that that was so freaking on the nose.
Yeah, what you're both talking about is you feel complicit. You feel part of it. You feel it's part of a community of people who are talking to you. You're getting the joke. The joke is being pitched at you.
Mm-hmm.
It's charming. It's done with a wink.
Yeah.
I have thought of a couple examples where it really didn't work for me, and that's this was years ago. I sent one of my nephews, funny kid, smart kid, a DVD of the film Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Because the kid's funny, and he likes comedy. And I was anticipating the all-caps email I would get. And I got it. Because that film plays with the conventions of filmmaking, conventions of medieval myth.
It does.
But then it kind of comes to this incredible halt that is meant to be funny, meant to be, we've dashed your expectations, ha, 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 ha.
Yeah.
But you are so in the moment because it's done such a great job of setting you up.
Yeah.
That's another movie that earns it.
Yes, yeah. That absolutely earns it. I'm still pissed at it.
Yeah. yeah. You know, it's funny. One that I would mention from my adolescence, right, sort of the time when your comedy sensibility is being formed, and the first network TV show, primetime TV show, where I can remember seeing this was on Moonlighting.
Sure.
They did this on Moonlighting extensively, partly to cover the fact that they kept having these production delays. It's kind of a thing you don't hear about happening a whole lot now, but that show would like have a new episode scheduled, and then at the last minute there wouldn't be one because it wasn't done.
Put something else in.
And all of a sudden it would just be a rerun, and it would be, you know, new ones for a while and then no new ones for 4 weeks. It was an extremely troubled show. And so they would do a lot of these little drop-ins where they would explain why the show was delayed. How come the show wasn't on this week? How come the show wasn't on last week? What happened? And then they started more and more to have these little moments where there was one moment where she was saying something that was sort of very potentially dirty. She was like naming body parts and she was kind of, you know, and he said, if you go any lower, they're going to move us to cable. And it was these little drop-ins where it was always just on the edge of being talked about on that show. Like they weren't quite talking about it, but any minute you could hear, you know, something would happen and they would acknowledge that they were on a TV show.
Yeah, right.
From the realm of theater, of course, one of my favorite artifacts that does this is a little musical called Urinetown, which is a parody of every single musical that's ever been written. But it's also got these two fantastic characters, Little Sally and Officer Lockstock, who are constantly commenting on everything that's happening on stage and indicating that they know why that thing is happening, because it's a trope, because it's a money note. It's an 11 o'clock number.
It feels like it's definitely been very common in the theater. Sometimes where you have, like, I'm thinking of like an Our Town, you know, where mm-hmm. you've got yeah. somebody who's there to sort of point out, well, here the characters are doing this. And I would imagine there are a lot of opportunities to do that kind of gag.
Oh, absolutely. And it's not always a gag. It comes from the sort of essential nature of theater itself. Henry V, the chorus, tells you, we're in a theater, we don't have many resources, and we're going to try to recreate this invasion mm-hmm. of France.
Right.
Pippin is like that, too. Pippin is massively meta.
Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead is the perfect example mm-hmm. of the meta theatrical experience.
Yeah.
It's the characters from Hamlet
yeah.
who don't get much to do in Hamlet.
Right.
And see the other characters passing in all their size and all their grandeur, and these guys are sitting there flipping coins
right.
and trying to figure out how they can break free of this narrative.
Getting back to Thornton Wilder, there is a play that when I saw it as a young boy, really blew me away because it was using meta-commentary to actually move the audience, to affect the audience in a way that was deeply sincere and deeply emotional. It's called The Skin of Our Teeth.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, a lot of people dismiss Thornton Wilder as sort of hokey and Mrs. Gibbs heliotropes and all that stuff. First of all, Our Town is a much darker and smarter play than you recall. The Skin of Our Teeth is this amazing play about this family that lives in suburban Montclair, New Jersey in modern day, but they're also the human race. So their travails are the human race's travails. So the first act opens with an ice age happening. The dad is going off to invent the wheel. And as the ice age approaches, their mammoth wants to come inside, but they're not letting him come inside. And the first act ends with an actress going to the front of the stage and saying, pull up your chairs. We need to keep the fire going. Save the human race. The third act begins with the stage manager coming out, very nervous, and saying that there's been an episode of food poisoning backstage. And so they've sent the cast home, and so we're going to go run through this next bit here with some of the members of the stage crew. And the stage crew comes on stage, and they rehearse something, and then the play goes on. And that's when I realized that acting like a real person, acting like you're not acting, is the most difficult kind of acting.
Oh, so difficult. So, so difficult. Uh-huh. The only thing stranger than The Skin of Our Teeth is the musical that Kandra Nebb made of The Skin of Our Teeth.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. This play, you can actually see the production I saw back in 1983. It's on American Playhouse. There's a DVD of it. Stars mm-hmm. Blair Brown, Seda Thompson, Henry Gould. It's fantastic. But what it does is it really made you appreciate. I can't imagine what it would have been like to be in the theater when that happened.
The first time?
Yeah. It's just fantastic.
To bring this a little bit back to 30 Rock, one of the things I admire about the way they've employed this on 30 Rock is that it becomes a way to do satire. And so mm-hmm. I think one of the things that defines when it works and when it doesn't work for me is, do you have something to say? Mm-hmm. Because it's one thing to make cute references to your own show, the fact that your own show is about to get canceled, the fact that your own show is in trouble. I have always been surprised at how much they got away with in terms of buffoonizing GE and NBC. I mean, that show, the pilot episode of that show involves Alec Baldwin as Jack Donaghy introducing himself as the head of television and microwave oven programming. And he goes on to explain this new oven that they're all excited about, which was a real thing. The oven was real. And he gives this ridiculous pitch for this real oven. And the stuff they've done that hasn't worked for me as well, I am tired of the sort of like, let's do product placement while talking about how much we hate product placement. Yeah. But the stuff that has worked, I think, is the business. If you see the episode where he explains that NBC is actually owned by the Shinehart Wig Company, which is a subsidiary of this, which is a subsidiary of that.
Poker,
which is,
or something.
And it's right. There's a poker one. And then it's all underneath the appliances part of GE. Mm-hmm. That, to me, is really clever because that is exposing a real thing that really exists. You know, a lot of you know that I worked at Television Without Pity when it was owned by Bravo. And I didn't really understand why Bravo? Why not just, well, it was part of Bravo. So it's kind of like, and I think it still is, which I didn't completely understand. But when I saw that chart and they were like, this is part of this and this is part of this, it was like, you know, big companies really do sort of look like that, where it, maybe not to that extreme. But
maybe
they
not
really,
the wig company.
But they really do, right, not the wig company. But they do have those interesting levels. And especially the first season of 30 Rock seemed to me to be such a sharp satire about networks messing with comedies. And there were two episodes back to back, one where Jack decided he wanted to be a writer and one where Jack was pressed into service as an actor. And in both of them, the message was, can't do it, can't do it, can't do it, doesn't understand comedy, can't do it. And so to me, it sort of put the company in a position where now you sort of have to leave the show alone once you've allowed it to establish this tone where one of the topics of mockery is the network messing with the show. Mm-hmm. Then if you are NBC, and of course, they had already messed with the show a certain amount. It was supposed to be Rachel Dratch and what became the Jenna Maroney character. Right. So they had already messed with it a certain amount. But I always felt like once she made that one of the big things, Jack messing with the show, it sort of gives you this interesting place to stand where you're saying one of our entire points is don't mess with our show.
To the point where I actually am a little bit skeptical of it. I've seen it done so many times, you know, where The Simpsons is constantly digging at Fox.
Right.
And where there's almost this kind of they don't care whose toes they step on, where I feel like networks are so used to it that they're not really – I feel like nowhere is there like a stuffed shirt.
No,
just, oh,
no I don't think so either. And one of the things that I think makes it work for me on 30 Rock better than it has on some other places is there is no venerating of the inside the show TGS that they're all geniuses.
Right.
If you look at most of the in-show sketches, and 30 Rock, as many people remember, premiered the same fall as Studio 60, mm-hmm. which everybody thought was the one that was going to be the big hit because it was an Aaron Sorkin show and an hour-long drama and so forth. But on Studio 60, and people have talked about this a million times, they tried to write sketches that were supposed to be brilliant.
Yeah.
And they could not, and the sketches were terrible, and it was, ugh. On 30 Rock, what they give you is 3 seconds at a time of sketches, and they look ridiculous and terrible.
Right.
There are too many farts in this engine.
So although they're taking, and what you see, like Jenna's musical numbers and stuff like that, what you see is so ridiculous that although they are making digs at the network, it doesn't have that feeling of like, we're awesome and the network is dumb.
Right.
Because
every project they get involved with is just absurd.
They are all ridiculous and everything they do in the show looks ridiculous. And from the first time you see them performing, it's just ridiculous, silly junk. And so it's to me, they give some balance so it doesn't come off like a hatchet job on the network, the kind of thing Steven's talking about where it's like, ooh, yeah, look at us making little
digs. We don't care whose toes we step on.
Exactly. Because yeah. I agree. I have little patience with that.
Yeah. On The Simpsons, you just imagine Rupert Murdoch going, here, have some more finger paint, kids. Go crazy. Right. Over in that corner.
Right, like, oh, exactly. You want me to appear on the show again?
Sure.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I think that's one of the things that's...
It's a chance to make us look like good sports. You know, that's what you're getting on.
That does happen. And that's why I think my favorite thing about it was that it continued to have not only that balance of the show was also stupid, but the network, although it was a bunch of buffoons, was also represented by Jack, who very often knows what he's talking about.
Right.
Even about the show, and would even say, like, well, this is what you have to do about this writer or this person. And sometimes he would be right.
Right.
Everybody on that show is wrong mostly, but allowed to be right occasionally when it's in balance. Yeah. And my whole thing when I felt like it got out of balance was that she was always wrong and Jack was always right. And I feel like they got a little addicted to that dynamic where she would grudgingly realize he was right. And they could play that very funny. Alec Baldwin and Tina Fey got very good at playing those scenes very funny. But it was out of balance. And I think this season they've done better rebalancing that show.
Nice.
So please come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH and tell us what you think about meta commentary.
Well, and you'll find us just tearing down the fourth wall by popping in and commenting. It's like they're human beings computers.
There is no fourth wall. And speaking of which, what we thought we would do with the middle section of our show today, fortunately, many of you are new. If all of you had been around since the show started, that would be sad for us.
Yes.
Because that would mean that none of you, there was no growth.
Right.
And it was the same 10 of you who probably were here for our first episode. So we do notice from time to time that we have a tendency to refer to things we've talked about before or shortcut, shorthand things that we've talked about. So we thought that we would offer an opportunity to answer some questions.
Let's get everybody caught up. But the important thing is, don't let any of your friends listen to the show after this. We want no new listeners.
This is the end. Fortunately, this is going to be the one that we can all refer back to if we need to tell anyone where the answer to something can be found.
Exactly.
I think A1 is what is the Zaxxon rule.
Yeah, a lot of people are.
Stephen, why don't you explain the Zaxxon rule?
The Zaxxon rule originates with the What's Making Us Happy segment,
right,
in which for several weeks running, I talked about how what was making me happy was that I might be buying a Zaxxon machine on Craigslist.
Zaxxon is an arcade game.
It is a 1982 Sega arcade classic.
There you go.
I bought a gigantic full-size arcade version of Zaxxon on Craigslist, but I managed to talk about it over the course of several weeks.
Yep.
And what ended up happening was we kind of had a little bit of an internal discussion, like, hey, how about...
More like an intervention.
A little bit like an intervention. And I think most of us have been guilty of it to a varying degree, but primarily me, talking about things that are making us happy that cannot necessarily be enjoyed by other people. The idea of the What's Making Us Happy segment is to recommend things that people can try out, and unless you have keys to my house, which you don't, you know, you cannot actually enjoy my Zaxxon.
We were taking the name of the segment a little too literally.
Yeah. So the Zaxxon rule is not necessarily don't ever, but watch out for.
Watch out for and kind of
mentions of things that are strictly from your personal life.
Yes, and in an alternative universe, it's sometimes referred to as the Trey's Nephews rule.
It is. It's the Zaxxon / Nephews rule, and then we shortened it. But it's also...
/ Linda baking things.
But it's also used primarily in the context of, I know this is about to violate the Zaxxon rule, so we're incredibly diligent
We do often observe it in the breach, I would say. All right. Another question that I enjoyed a lot is essentially whether Mike's band is real. By the way, Mike's band is called Hello Come In, not Hello Command, which was one of the questions that we were asked. Was Hello Command a real band? Hello Come In was a band that Mike was in. Our previous producer, our original producer, Mike Katzen.
Our music director and producer emeritus.
Exactly. Mike was in this band, Hello Come In. They provided this music, which Mike picked out for us.
Mm-hmm.
And that is Mike on the acoustic guitar. The strummy acoustic guitar is indeed Mike Katzen. And we asked him, when we did our very first episode, to pick something.
Yep.
As I recall, that was our guidance.
Our guidance was, yeah, I trust you, buddy.
I mean, our guidance was, you make music, and that way we wouldn't have to figure out how to license it or whether we can use it or not if it just comes from our producer.
Yeah. So. And literally, like, none of us asked to hear it beforehand. We heard it the same time more
Correct.
Or less.
But it is not an operational band currently.
No.
It is a former band.
And it has always been it's a project that Mike was working on with a couple of his friends who actually lived in different cities.
Right.
So it's kind of one of those sending tracks back and forth. I don't believe, ever been a live performance by the band Hello Command or the band Hello Command.
Now, among the FAQs, is there the question, what is the title of the Kiki music?
You know, I don't think that that came up. It has come up in the past sometimes. The music, by the way, is referred to as Kiki.
Not Kinky.
Not Kinky.
Which was another one of our occasionally asked questions.
I don't know if it has a title.
We'll ask Mike. We'll get him to come and tell you if it has a title. It probably has some name or other. It's probably not Track 8.
It's called Track 8.
But it is not available, unfortunately, for your ringtone downloading or anything like that.
But that'll always be the dream.
That'll always be the dream.
Mike is quite adamant on that score.
That is true. We also got the question, I have occasionally gotten the question, why do I say the music is Kiki every week?
Which hasn't always been the case.
Essentially, we were looking originally for ways to open the show.
Mm-hmm.
And one of these guys, it was one of you, someone suggested to me, refer to the fact that that's the music playing and so forth. So I started doing that. And if you listen to old episodes, there is a period of time in which I was saying different things about it every week. But I was exhausting myself thinking of new adjectives. And so I just went with Kiki, which is undoubtedly Trey's word, because that is a,
yeah,
that
I was going to say.
That's a Trey word.
It might have been my word. It might have been a Barry word, but it's probably
know.
Me.
I think it's you, buddy.
I think it's a Trey word.
Yeah.
So, okay, next topic. Stephen, do you think we should get married?
Oh, my God.
The people demand.
I was thinking, and Linda
did
and
you
I,
hear how I went, oh.
Linda and I were talking
That's
about
the
this.
The ego stroke a lady likes.
Yeah, Linda and I
the
were.
The fact that he can do that in front of me is how you know it's not a thing.
Linda and I were exchanging emails on this topic.
Not about getting married.
Not about getting married. And we debated the idea of just simultaneously going, yuck! But no, Linda and I are not getting married.
No.
We are, as the kids say, friends. For Pete's sake, it's actually a thing where sometimes boys are friends with girls.
Yeah. It's kind of shocking.
It's not happening, people.
You guys got your own shippers.
Yeah. It's kind of freaking me out.
Fan fiction.
No fan fiction, no shippers.
No.
Not happening.
You have summoned it into being.
We love you.
Just by mentioning it.
We love you people very much, except for anyone who would do that.
Yeah, so that's no. You heard it. I proposed. He said no. It's all over. Now I have to go and cry into my beer. Speaking of which,
yes.
Here's another question we got. I'll throw this one to Glenn. You haven't talked too much.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn doesn't like it when we talk about ourselves, so this is not his favorite segment anyway, but I'm going to make him answer this one. Mm-hmm. Do we actually go out after the show?
We try. We certainly try. We do. Usually, Stephen has his kids to get home to.
Sorry, I have to miss the show.
That's true.
Generally speaking, the rest of us, including Jess, go out to someplace nearby for dinner, actually, and a drink or six.
Mm-hmm.
We used to go to a place that we have referred to as Feet Bar.
Yes.
It's not its actual name. But it smells like feet.
It's a bar. We're not going to tell you where it is because we might one day go back and then that would be weird. Because we're
just going to get stalked, right?
I don't think that's a thing.
It's probably not a thing.
Well, no, I don't think he wants the people at Feet Bar to be upset with
us.
Exactly.
Right.
I think that's fair.
I just said it smelled like feet.
It smells like
feet. It doesn't
smell
that much.
It smells like feet, stale beer, and old vomit, actually.
No,
yeah,
they serve Liney's, Sunset Wheat,
Leinenkugel's,
my favorite.
No, you can't say that. People will know where it is. It's a perfectly nice bar that smells
Wisconsin
like
beer. It doesn't smell that much.
I think
like
it's
feet.
A perfectly fine place to have a drink, but
anyway,
Trey is fussy.
There is no food at Feet Bar, so
that's
we have moved on to a different place that does serve food. It is, after all, we tape this usually at 6. We get out of here at 7:15, so I am hungry. And, and this is actually, there was another part of the question. This is pretty much the only time of the week I see you guys, because I come from my day job.
Right.
So you guys work in the same cubicle, but this is pretty much the only time chance.
In the same cubicle. We sit in the same chair.
Yes.
One gets the middle, one gets each arm.
You get to left click, you get to right click.
I think that's one reason people think we're married.
Yeah. Good God. despite the behavior you're hearing at the moment, the related question is often, do you have a real happy hour during the taping of the show?
Not
and that, the answer to that is no.
And I would say never. I don't think any of us has ever had a drop of alcohol in our system.
No, this is a real thing. We take it seriously.
It's
more or less.
We're at work.
Can't you tell? Yeah. So that was one. I got the question, how much is the show edited? So, you know.
The answer is really well.
Yeah. The show is edited for, certainly some of it is taking out mistakes and false starts and things like that, so that you don't have to listen to too much of
and
that.
The sound of Steven's Diet Coke.
Hold on one second.
The sound of Steven opening cans of Diet Coke. But it is also edited to take out meanderings down paths that go nowhere. So.
Exactly.
Yeah.
My 977 uses of sort of or basically in every episode.
No, don't tell them. They'll notice now.
Then they'll listen.
We do all have little tics that we try to break ourselves of.
We are not what is known as polished radio professionals.
We have definitely all had to work some of those little kinks out.
My favorite part is where Barry Hardiman, the actual full-time radio professional, bangs into the microphone and we have to restart the whole segment.
Absolutely. That does occasionally happen. So, origin story. Stephen, do you want to tell the origin story?
Yeah, Linda Holmes was sitting in my living room platonically. Because we're friends and she comes over and we drink beer and hang out and
we're
talk.
Making out. No.
No.
It's so
stop.
Weird. Even no, saying yeah. it is so no. weird. I'm sorry, I just freaked myself out. It's so weird. I'm sorry.
Usually you're the one who suppresses vomiting when we talk about this.
I have cousins. It would be less weird. I have family members. It would be less weird. Go ahead.
So Holmesy's over visiting, and we're sitting around talking. We had been sort of bandying about the idea of at some point doing something audio-wise. You and I had already done some live blogging of things like where we would spend an hour doing IM chat about American Idol. Mm-hmm. And then we would just cut and paste it and put it up on the blog because you and I tend to IM and text and do everything in complete sentences.
Right.
And so we had talked about why don't we do sort of an audio version of this? Why don't we try out an audio version of this? And we had been sort of bandying that idea around for a while. And eventually you and I were sitting around talking and I do not remember which one of us came up with any given idea. But in my living room, in a span of about 5 minutes, about a week or two before we actually recorded it, we said, hey, we should do a roundtable discussion show called Pop Culture Happy Hour, in which you and I, and let's bring in Trey, and I had not met Glenn Weldon at this point, but you had spoken of him so highly that
I think I met Glenn like twice, maybe two or three times.
And you had spoken so highly of him, I do remember that I said, how about that guy Glenn Weldon? You said he'd be great. It seems like he would be great from what you're saying. But then it was like, well, we can't do it without a producer. Let's get Mike Katziff. Right. It was literally everyone who was associated with the show, everything that the show was called. We didn't know exactly what it was going to entail, how long it would be.
We dreamed it into being, though.
But we dreamed it into being entirely as it turned out to be.
Right.
And there were no focus groups. There were no meetings.
We prided ourselves for the first year and a half, 2 years of the show on never having had a meeting. Now we've had some meetings and they've been actually been good.
We sort of walked by a couple of managers and said, hey, we think we might try this thing.
Right.
And that was it.
Yeah. Well, that was the way it was sold, I think. It was sold to me as, well, you know, we're going to try it. Probably won't go anywhere. We'll probably just put the tape someplace. So that's why I was like, sure.
And
that's
what
we'll do.
It was like, well, you know, I've got a blog. We'll just put the audio up in the blog. We have a place to put it.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'll just put it up on the blog and then people will be able to hear it. And we'll probably, you know, we might do it again someday.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We might never do it again.
And I got to say, I mean, one thing I would really add to this is that NPR has been incredibly supportive of this project.
Yes,
that's true.
Indeed.
Never run into any resistance from NPR, which has been just a marvelous incubator for what we're doing here.
That's true. And I do want to add one other thing, which is some of these questions about how the show started and how people got picked seemed to presuppose that I ran it. Or that I picked people, or that I placed an ad in one case. That was a quick, did I place an ad? That was asked, which our former producer, Mike Katziff, suggested today that I could explain to everyone that it was a Craigslist missed connections. heard you talking about pop culture on the train. Please email me. But I actually have no different role here than anyone else, except that I sit behind the hosting thing. But this kind of leads into the next thing, which is how we decide what we're going to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Which everybody basically does part of that. That's essentially an email discussion every week. We used to try to get together, but it's really difficult to do. So we send around emails and we talk about what we think might be good for that week. And I am rarely the person who instigates that discussion. So it certainly doesn't come from me.
Yeah.
Not my fault.
And as for why we tape on Monday, but the show doesn't go up till Friday, I think it's just a matter of the fact that none of us, this is not any of our full-time jobs.
Right.
This
exactly.
is just a thing
it's
that we're all kind of squeezing.
It's to give the producer. Including Jess.
Exactly. Yeah,
it's to give the producer time to cut the show.
Right. Exactly.
It's to fit it into our schedules and then also give time for cutting. So.
Well, and we record the show after work. We
right.
record the show after hours.
It is after work right now.
It is literally, well, we're here.
It is theoretically after work right now. But I think that's most of the ones that I had. Do we pick on each other in real life? Was
just a bit.
It's true. If you saw us in our natural habitat, if we're sitting around talking about normal things, we don't pick at each other. But
well, I think part
I banter with all you people outside of the show.
Well, I mean, I think part of the idea of the show is that we would want to have these conversations
right.
whether we were taping them or not. And
right.
that was kind of one of our goals.
Right. To make no extra work. things we would talk about anyway. Just turn the tape on.
Do you want to clarify the Culturetopia versus
yes. The other people to whom we owe a debt of gratitude, I would say, is the NPR Arts Desk, who at the time were doing a podcast called Culturetopia. And it was a combination of art stories from the week. They discontinued that show, but we had asked them and they had agreed to let us essentially share their podcast feed.
Yep.
So for a long time, every week you got an episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour and an episode of Culturetopia on that feed, which was cool because, frankly, you could get some nifty NPR art stories.
Yeah.
They discontinued doing that and we basically stayed. So we basically squatted there on their feed until they wound up abandoning that project. So we do owe them a gigantic debt of gratitude.
Because
otherwise we would have had to start a whole new podcast feed,
right.
which would have required meetings. Almost certainly would have required meetings. So I think that's most of the
well. Let me just
I had.
This has come up several times, and I just talked.
Oh yeah.
And I talked about it at the live show a little bit, and with some folks afterwards. But here's the thing. My voice does not sound like Trey's voice.
I don't think it does either.
No, and my voice does not sound like Glenn's voice.
Exactly.
Or your voice right now.
I know, right?
And it used to really bug me when some stupid joke of mine would get attributed to Trey. It doesn't bother me anymore. Because here's the thing about me and stupid jokes. It's a renewable resource.
Yeah. I can make more.
Yeah. I can make more. I can always make more.
Okay.
And generally speaking, when something that Trey says is attributed to me, I come out looking pretty good in that kind of thing. Because I generally sound more intelligent, more erudite, so I'm fine
please.
With that.
Yeah.
The thing that bugs me to this day is that I have pretty much formed large chunks of my self-image around the fact that I never use certain words. Words that are always flopping out of Trey Graham's mouth. So we should create like a flow chart, an if-then sort of flow chart.
Oh, I am so down with this.
If you hear the word naughty.
Especially with that intonation.
That's Trey. That's not Glenn. That's Trey. Similarly, the word delicious, used in a non-food, well, actually, no. Just any time you hear the word delicious, that's Trey. Stunning is also Trey.
Mm-hmm.
Bustle. Not a thing I talk about. A word I don't use. Unless it's in somebody's hedgerow, then I might bring it up. Pocket gay, gross. I wouldn't say that. So there's many of these things. But, I don't hear it, certainly. I also don't hear the you and Barry thing. People say that you and
yeah,
Barry.
People do say that.
I do hear that.
I think Linda and Barry are closer than Trey and Glenn.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe you just have to, I don't know.
I'm just going to have to go back to talking Southern.
You.
But nobody
that would work. That was Trey, by the way.
Yeah, nobody talks like me.
No, it's true. You're very easy to identify. You're the one who talks about books. All right. Well, I want to thank all of you who submitted questions at our Facebook page.
And we'll do this again.
We'll do this again. We'll come back to it someday when we feel like getting, meta again.
That's right.
And that brings us to our final segment, what is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
An incredibly depressing song.
I saw some guys dressed up like sorcerers. Blue robes that float above the ground. They They came and went, and I was frightened for my life. I tried not to make a sound. Just when my solitude was closing in, I heard a howl like screeching tires. And I told you the one thing I know how to say through the bright ringing drone of 8-bit choirs. Yeah, when you came in, I could breathe again.
Okay.
I don't know whether I want to shoot myself or the singer or the person who mic'd the snare so closely.
Oh, for Pete's sake, man.
Sorry. This is happy. This is happy time.
Good Lord. What is the matter with you, you monster? You twisted wreck.
You haven't even heard what's making me happy yet.
All right. Just get back to
it. All right. We have discussed on this show things that are made for us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is the Mountain Goats, who I've talked about on this show before. The singer, whose name I have been mispronouncing for years and years and years, is John Darnielle.
Mm-hmm.
The song is called Thank You, Mario, But Our Princess Is in Another Castle. And it is entirely about the original Super Nintendo Mario Brothers game.
Mm-hmm.
It's John Darnielle recording with the guitarist Khaki King, whose voice comes in late on an EP from 2008, which, as gigantic a Mountain Goats fan as I am, I had never heard. And one of our listeners on Twitter sent me a note like, do you know about this song? And now I do. It is from it's from an EP called Black Paratree, and it is devastating. I've listened to it again and again and again and again.
Just being devastated over and over again.
And when I sent it to our producer, Jess Gittner, she wrote back, this is in my top 25 most played. So apparently I'm just way behind.
You are.
John Darnielle has been making several appearances on the Judge John Hodgman podcast as a guest expert. He's really good on that show.
He is a damn genius, and the dude has written hundreds and hundreds of songs, and it is amazing how many of them are amazing.
Very good. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
Well, I'm really mad at Trey.
All right.
That was mostly chain yanking, just so you know. Well, word of this project has been kicking around for some time. It's not a brand new idea, but the world of the theater is abuzz this week with the news that the actual Tina Fey Mean Girls musical project may be close to happening. So that is a thing that I could get behind.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really have much more to say about it than that. The Mean Girls musical is on the horizon, apparently, according to her being interviewed at the SAG Awards.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe she said her husband is writing the music, so I'm down with that.
Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
That Mitchell and Webb look is a British sketch comedy show that I like very much, but it's been around for a while. It stars David Mitchell and Robert Webb. They also have a sitcom called Peep Show, which I've avoided for years. It's in its eighth season. I've avoided it for years because I like sketch comedy, and I didn't want to see these two tremendously talented actors, performers, comedians, trapped in two roles for a long time. It just seemed like a waste of their talents. I was incredibly wrong. Peep Show is fantastic. The idea of it is that there are these two roommates, Mark, who's kind of a cynical, self-loathing loan officer, and Jeremy, who is a freeloading musician with a very inflated sense of self. It's presented as point of view, literally point of view. You see through the characters' eyes as they look at each other and talk. But you also hear what each one is thinking. And the comedy comes from the distance between what they're thinking and what they say to each other, to everybody else. I'm not going to give you the best lines this show has ever had, because there's several. I will tell you the three lines that really scared me, because it's like, this show is inside my head.
Mm-hmm.
This show gets me. The first, Jeremy is on the phone, and he says at one point, I really think that all of our major differences will just sort of melt away as long as we don't try to confront them too early. That is a really great line. That is like management style. That's the Weldon management style. The second one is that the cynical character Mark goes to a movement class against his better judgment, and just as the instructor is talking about trailing the yellow energy, he thinks to himself, she'll be telling us to use the force next. If you ask me, Skywalker was bloody lucky to get away with shutting off his guidance system. Now, that is a thought I have had. That has occurred to me. Well, every time I see it, I'm like, Luke, that is a very expensive piece of equipment. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been calibrated to do this job. It is a targeting computer. You're targeting. Mm-hmm. But the thing that really confronted me, the thing that really kind of grabbed me, was this line. What happens in this scene is that Mark is at work late at night. He's bonding with this guy he's just met. They're kind of horsing around at the office, and he comes to a startling realization.
I've got a friend. I've made a friend. Maybe there's nothing wrong with me, and I'm just a normal human being.
I was like, get out of my mind. Oh, I love this show. It's Peep Show. It's available on Netflix streaming. It's great. Real quick, want to do one more. I know I've been talking a while, but let's do this real quick. My grandmother, Catherine Johnson, at the age of 95, died this Saturday. Oh. It was her time. It was a mercy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Every family seems to have, like, the awesome grandmother and the less awesome grandmother. She was the awesome grandmother. She...
You just ranked your grandmother.
You do. Everybody does. You know, you have the one that... Well, she was awesome. She ran the Strawbridge and Clothiers ladies department for 30 years with an iron fist, but she was very doting. She also, on her grandkids, she made, you know, her Welsh cookies recipe has been passed down. And the Welsh cookie, as cookies go, is a very daunting, forbidding cookie. It's not for the bowl.
Not for sissies.
It's not sweet. It's hard. It's dry. And the only sweetness in it comes from currants. But you grow up with it, you'll love it. But she, the reason I'm talking about her and flouting the Zaxxon rule, even though I am the one who harangues you all about flouting the Zaxxon rule,
you are.
Is that she nurtured my pop culture obsessions growing up as a young nerdling. She made me I asked for my sixth Christmas, a real Superman outfit. And she made it. And, you know, she took a thick gray sweatsuit that she dyed blue. And, you know, it wasn't skin tight. It didn't look anything like the real Supermans, but it was fine. It was fine. I remember, I don't think I was mean about it, but I probably was an ungrateful churl, but I pretended that it was.
That's why she's haunting this podcast right now.
But at age 11, I asked her for a Doctor Who scarf. Aww. And she knitted me. This woman, this poor woman, a Doctor Who scarf, for those of you who don't know, is 14 feet long, consists of 8 colors, and just rows after rows after rows. So this poor woman knitted me a Doctor Who scarf, and I absolutely loved it. So what's making me happy this week is really awesome grandmas like Catherine Morris Frances Johnson.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
What a wonderful tribute. That sounds great. Okay, 2 things making me happy this week. Neither of them are as good as, certainly, Glenn's.
Yeah.
But
that song is so good. What's wrong with you people? You are monsters.
I'm not saying anything bad about your song, you big baby. Okay, one is in Ad Week today, there was an oral history of Deadspin, which is the sports blog. Now, when I first saw the link, I thought, there are officially too many oral histories, which I do think is true. I thought, I don't know if I need an oral history of Deadspin. Like, I like Deadspin. They've been in the news recently because they broke the Monty Teo thing. But I looked at it, and my first thought was, I don't think so. But I read it. Will Leach, who started Deadspin, is someone I sort of a tiny bit know through the internet.
Right.
Like, never met. And I like listening to Will talk about stuff like this. So I went in to read it. And indeed, it's completely fascinating. Wow. They talk about sort of how Gawker decided to start a sports blog because it's in the Gawker family. How it's changed. There's some very careful talk from Will about why it's not what he would want to be doing anymore, both because it has changed and because he has changed. Very interesting, very diplomatic, but made very clear. So Deadspin oral history at Adweek. We'll link to that. It's very cool. The other thing is the best and most romantic New York Times wedding story of all time, ever, ever. As you know, if you read the New York Times wedding stories, they are usually insufferable to the point where they have entire Tumblrs and blogs devoted to making fun of them.
Now, maybe the greatest journalistic moment of my life is when I got quoted in one of those as Mr. Thompson, which is all I wanted on earth.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
Okay. This one was better than that. This was the story of the wedding of Ada Laurie Bryant, age 97,
aww,
and Robert Mitchell Hare, age 86. Now, Mrs. Bryant is the mother of Jane Bryant Quinn. So that sort of gives you a little idea of perhaps how the New York Times got onto this story. Mm-hmm. But basically what happens is they meet at a retirement place where she has lived for a long time after the death of her husband. He moves in with his wife. His wife, a couple of years ago, gets a diagnosis of Lou Gehrig's disease and dies about a year later. And he asks this woman, Mrs. Bryant, to make a, I believe it was a portrait of his wife, a mural or a portrait or something like that. So they work together on this and they become friends. And they begin going to eat together because they admit to each other that they do not like eating alone because now they are both on their own.
Sure.
And they know that it is possible that this will get them tagged as a couple by the other gossips in the retirement
home. They should record a pop culture podcast together.
But they actually did go to dinner together. And eventually, you know, he talks in the piece about how it was very difficult for him to express his feelings to her. And he says, I can guarantee you it does not get any easier, even with advanced age. And he talks about how he was trying to find the right balance of boldness, but also, you know, caution.
Sure.
And he was essentially nervous about saying anything about his feelings. And originally, they begin to discuss marriage, but she declines. But after a long time, they talk about it a lot more. And he essentially tells her, I'm going to care for you the same, whether we get married or not. So don't worry about it. My commitment to you and to be, you know, with you and care for you is the same either way, but I still would like us to get married. And eventually she says yes. And so they get married. And there's a wonderful, wonderful picture of them. And this is the end of the New York Times story. She explained why she first turned him down. There's a great difference in our ages, as you can see, she said. I didn't think it was the thing to do because I don't have that many years ahead of me. But he said, that's all the more reason. I like him very much. I love him. So we're going to be married. And it is truly the most, and one of the things that Gawker pointed out, and I have to credit Gawker, which is the first place I saw this, is that it is wonderful and romantic without being patronizing. It's
right.
Not infantilizing.
Yeah.
It doesn't say, oh, they're so cute. Mm-hmm. Oh, they're so good. It, except in the way that you would do it with any couple in love, like I think is what's motivating Stephen to sort of keep going, oh, any couple in love. It doesn't come across as like, look at the ancient old people.
Right.
It does a very good job of balancing
that. Who are still capable
of
human feeling.
Well, of course, exactly. Like that all of a sudden love becomes adorable instead of romantic.
Right.
It is adorable only in the sense that all stories like this are adorable and it's extremely romantic. I mean, I just found this story. There's a moment where he gives her a sonnet. It's shocking. It is absolutely shockingly romantic and wonderful. And I loved it. And that is the other thing making me happy this week. And that brings us, right. And we will absolutely link to that because everyone must read it. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me in the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon, WELDON. You can follow our producer, Jess Gittner, at Jess Gittner, GITNER. You can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's very real band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are listening to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.